Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1 with Allcare Pharmacy. Get expert advice from your friendly healthcare team at Allcare Pharmacy, Ireland's largest community pharmacy network.
Welcome back. Áine Kerr here, sitting in for Brendan. Now, we're only 5 weeks out from the US presidential election, so that's where we're going to now to hear from acclaimed writer and close observer of politics, Colm McCann. Colm, good morning.
Good morning.
Colm, take the pulse for us a little bit this morning. The poll of polls is still suggesting closest election in modern history. Does it feel that way from your vantage point?
It absolutely feels that way. There's a lot of confusion. There's, you know, some days the polls come out and people think it's going to sway one way, and then just a couple of days later, it's swaying the other. The temperature of the country is hard to gauge, except in its absolutes, the people who are absolutely supporting Trump and the people who are absolutely supporting Harris. It's quite fascinating to be in the midst of all this, which essentially amounts to a certain turbulence that you get swirled around in. So we are in turbulent times, tumultuous times, and it's fascinating to think that it's only 5 weeks out. There's still so much that can happen, of course.
You're based in New York, where one of the absolutes, well, close to, one would say, is that it will lean Democratic. But as you go outside a state like New York, what concerns, what insights are you hearing and seeing, maybe when it comes to the big issues of the day, taxation, inflation, immigration?
Yeah, it's really interesting. Actually, I've been spending a little bit of time building out an old house in Connecticut. Now, Connecticut, as you know, is very close to New York, and it generally leans blue. But so I've been working with electricians and roofers and people who are in the building trade, and it's been quite fascinating to talk with them. And a lot of them are leaning towards Trump, and I really kind of wanted to listen to them and try to understand exactly why. I mean, there's some of them are genuinely conservative, and some of them are worried about immigration, and you know, but there doesn't seem to be a concern that he was impeached twice and had multiple criminal indictments and many of these things that would put so many of us off. And I'm fascinated. And I said, so do you guys watch television? And no, there's no television watching going on, certainly not of you know, the major news stations. And do you read newspapers? No, I'm not reading the newspapers, but I'm getting all my news through you know, these various social media sites, and I have to respect that. And yet I wonder what's going on. And when I dig a little bit deeper, some of them tell me some of the most, you know, outrageous things about these, you know, conspiracies, that 9/11 was a conspiracy and so on. And these are smart, interested people. It's not like they're completely marginalized.
And they represent almost half the country that is leaning towards Trump for their vote. And when you're engaging with them, are they equally asking questions of you and quote unquote mainstream media, and whether you can believe all you read and hear and see?
Well, I think it's a good thing that I have to ask myself the same question. But they don't ask me, you know, what I'm reading. For example, you know, my wife teaches in a public school in New York, and now there are a lot of immigrants there, particularly coming from South America. She teaches English as a second language. And the men I talk to in Connecticut and in parts of Pennsylvania and in other parts of the country, they seem to think that New York is completely overrun and that there's a really wild mentality going on. Whereas, you know, if you talk with my wife, or if you live here in the city, you will see that it's really fairly ordered, and surely, yes, there are some good things not going on, but people tend to take a tiny photograph and blow it up into a portrait of a world that doesn't actually exist. And this is part of the danger, and I think we're not really listening to one another. And I think that Trump is tapping into an American anxiety about all of that stuff.
Where there's a lot of things now overinflated, manipulated, and therefore, do you feel the town square of facts doesn't exist in America today, that there just isn't the baseline of things everyone can sign up to as this is our collective truth?
Well, that's a really good question because, you know, facts can be mercenary things. They can be used by both sides or all sides, rather, and they can be packed off to whatever like little orphanage you want them to go to. You can use a fact in all sorts of ways, but the texture has been lost. You know, the real questions about, you know, the deeply human emotions, that's sort of been lost in this sort of these facts that get used and misused. And so it's fascinating to think, you know, we're in the quote unquote post-truth era. But what is the real truth and where is it going to come from? And I think it's people who really, you know, examine their own hearts in certain ways that will, you know, they'll change this election.
And in your conversations with tradesmen that you described, you know, when it comes down to trying to understand the texture, understand each other's quote unquote truth, what do you think are the issues driving them? Like, is it taxation, inflation, immigration that we see constantly in the headlines that is their core calls to action with Trump? What do they say about Harris in comparison to Trump?
Well, I think, you know, the most effective way to destroy debate is or to destroy people in general is to not give them a chance to speak. And part of the problem is that the people aren't speaking to one another and people aren't listening to one another. I'm in favor of the phrase "I don't know," because I do believe that we are living in times that are completely diseased with certainty. In other words, you have a channel of certainty and you must go into that channel of certainty. If you look like me, you vote like me, you sound like me, you come into the room and you dwell with me. There's none of this this murkiness that, you know, people should be saying, well, I'm confused. I'm confused about what's going on. Let's talk about it. Let's debate it. And there's very little debate going on. So I do believe that this disease of certainty is one of the things that's really hampering us. And what we have to do is somehow throw, listening and speaking and listening across divides, into the cauldron.
Because how do you do that in reality? Because we all find ourselves in moments like that where you have to resist the temptation to fact check, to lead by listening, lead with empathy, lead with curiosity. So is that the answer in some of these conversations that can be quite divisive between a Trump supporter and a Harris supporter right now?
Yeah, I think it's a generational thing. I think it's a thing that's going to take a while. I think it comes down to our teachers. You know, I've been traveling a lot this week and you go through the airports and you hear over the announcement, they say, you know, any military personnel, active military personnel, please come up and, you know, get on the aircraft first. And I respect that. That's fine as far as I'm concerned. But I can't wait until the day that we sort of acknowledge the teachers and say, okay, teachers, come up on board. And part of the problem is the education system has been sort of put into these channels of certainty, and teachers are having a hard time getting out, and there's not enough respect for them. But I do think there's no magic bullet for any of this. It's not necessarily a politician, but I do think it's a generational shift.
There's a huge concentration on so-called swing states, you know, be it the Arizona, Georgia, North Carolina, Pennsylvania, and therefore a huge concentration on undecided voters in order to kind of win the electoral college map. What of the youth vote in all of that, given, you know, you see the Taylor Swift endorsements, right, and the hundreds of thousands of registrations that followed that? Is the youth vote the one to watch here as well, Colm, based on what you're seeing on your travels around the United States?
I'm not sure that the youth vote is going to tip it. I wish it would. I will tell you this: my own 24-year-old son went down from New York to Philadelphia to try and register people. You know, he's a pro Kamala, but you know, he wanted to register people in general, and he spent days and days and days and hardly got anybody to register, because everybody is already registered. And this is kind of shocking. He said, "Dad, they're all registered already." And so people don't know what's going to happen. If everybody who is signed up to vote votes, you might see a spectacular sort of change. And these polls that are coming out might be completely wrong. But the young vote, I'm not so sure that they're going to completely swing things for Harris.
Do you think there is potentially, though, a history-making moment for her as the potentially first black female president of America? Or do you think, no, the tide will swing to Trump in the final weeks? We've got a VP debate to look forward to next week. Like, how would you forecast it 5 weeks out?
It's impossible to forecast. I will tell you this, that Obama's speechwriters said a story about Obama on the last day of his presidency. And he turned and said to them, "I think I was here too early. You know, I got here 10 years too early." And he might have been right for a while, certainly through the last few years. But in a certain way, that I feel that Obama prepared much of the territory for Harris to come in. Now, is the country going to be brave enough really change things and acknowledge a black woman president? I feel that it is possible, and there is an excitement in the air, but there's also a real tension in the air. And so you can feel it. The people, you don't want to talk to your taxi driver, you know, just in case, you know, he might be from the other side. And people, if you go through the rural areas, there's a blaze of Trump signs on one side and a blaze of Harris signs on the other. So there's that tension that's in the air.
And how much of that tension is down to concerns about threats, talk of violence? In a matter of weeks and months, we've seen two assassination attempts on President Donald Trump. Does that take up a lot of that unsaid, and where it's said, it's worries and anxiety about what yet could come?
Yeah. I mean, I personally must tell you, Anya, I'm terrified about another act of violence happening, no matter where it comes from or who it's perpetrated upon. That adds a real dynamic of nerves to the way that we're looking at this election. And, you know, if there's already been two attempts, there's going to be other people out there who are going to try to copycat this sort of thing. And that, to me, is something that will, you know, it certainly would tip the balance in extraordinary ways. It might even freeze an election, something that has never, ever, ever been seen before.
Do you think there is more of a state of readiness given the learnings from January 6th? And the riots that followed on that occasion, that there are learnings, there's a muscle memory there for the public and police and policymakers and politicians alike this time around?
Yeah, well, hatred might be a failure of the imagination, but it's also a failure of the memory. We forget these things. You know, even now, we sort of have forgotten a lot of what happened on January the 6th, because the repeated lie becomes the truth. People say, well, it wasn't so bad. It wasn't a riot. There was nobody hurt. And all of these things, which are lies, sort of enter the public domain. So a lot of what happens is, who gets to tell the story? What story will they tell? How truthful will it be? And, how can you combat some of the disinformation and the lies and sort of stand up with a sort of moral courage that you would hope these politicians would have? I do align Harris with at least, some moral courage. I don't agree with many of her aspects, especially in the policies in the Middle East and so on. But she has a sense of courage that's sort of dominant in her campaign.
One of the chapters yet to be written will be the debate between J.D. Vance and Tim Walz next week. You spent some time in Minnesota, the home of Governor Tim Walz. What are you expecting to see in that vice presidential debate next week? And do you think it can move the dial, given that all of the routines and rituals have moved away from watching live TV in the moment, you know, as a gathering, as a family, as a collective, sat around the TV? It's so different to decades ago, and maybe some of the nostalgia we have with that.
Well, I have to tell you that the last few debates, all the bars were packed out, you know, all the music was turned off, the jukeboxes were turned off, people were sitting there, they were listening, they were, you know, they weren't shouting out because they were a little bit concerned about, you know, being too blue or too red. But you know, in relation to this the upcoming debate, it's really interesting. You know, I was in Minneapolis, as you said, and in Minnesota, and they absolutely love Tim Walz there, like almost to a person. They find him to be completely extraordinary. I will also say that the younger population tend to really gravitate toward my own children. Find him to be very charming, indeed. I have more of a sense of the little boy Blue has lost his shoe with Vance, and I think Trump made a huge mistake in appointing J.D. Vance, and I think that it could be something that will tip a lot of people.
Yeah, we'll wait and see. I know obviously supporters of Trump and Vance will say Vance is helping shore up the base, and he's out on the ground, very, very visible at a time when Trump is kind of sticking to the more set pieces. Finally, Colm, obviously a lot happening as well in the Middle East conflict this week. It's a part of the world you spent a lot of time in, particularly as part of your own writing and meeting with a Palestinian father and an Israeli father. Have you spoken to them this week, given your continued friendship and discussions with them? And again, trying to lead with empathy and understanding, how are they doing? And what are your hopes and fears maybe coming out of a week like what we've just witnessed in the Middle East?
Well, they're completely shattered. You know, for a long time they have been angry. For the rest of the time they've been sad. They've been talking about being heartbroken. But then, with everything that's happening in Lebanon and the indiscriminate sort of killing that continues to go on, both of them said to me that they're feeling exhausted. And if they, these proponents of peace and peaceful engagement and dialogue, are feeling exhausted, it's not a good sign, because what we need in times like this is people to stand up. And so Rami and Bassam, who are the two gentlemen you're talking about, I think they need to be re-energized by some sort of movement. And whether that is something that comes from the groundswell, you know, they do get energy, by the way, from the protests in Ireland. Both men will say, oh, we saw that people are marching, you know, in support of Palestine in, you know, in Ireland, and people are taking the debate very, very seriously. So even everything that's happening at home actually happens elsewhere at the same time too. So, I mean, I would encourage all of us to start, you know, thinking about it, talking about it, continuing to debate it, because I think that'll get into the groundwater, and something has to get into the groundwater when we talk about peaceful engagement.
And you mentioned the word energy there, and when you reflect on US elections and geopolitics world over and this moment that you've written about of division but yet reconciliation, there's tragedy and yet there's hope. It's a mass of contradictions and inconsistencies all the time, and it's constant ambiguity and change. Where do you find your energy? Where do you find your hope, your solace in moments like this?
Well, there's a beautiful line in a series of 6th century Arabic pre-Islamic poems that goes, they're called the Mu'allakat. It goes, is there any hope that this desolation can bring us solace? And it's something I have tacked up on my wall here in New York. And I look at it sometimes. And when the news is raw, like it is right now, I think there's no solace. There's no way that you can get it. And yet you're sort of forced to believe that, you know, you can be like the Italian social scientist Gramsci says, you can be a pessimist of the intellect, and yet you can also be an optimist of the will. And so you can take all that pessimism and yet vault away from it at the same time. In fact, it maybe is our job to be deeply engaged and cynical about what is going on. And yet at the same time, as you so beautifully point out, like, you become the essence of contradiction. You're maybe, we'll call it a pes-optimist or a pessimist.
Well, on that hopeful note and having a bias to optimism and action, thank you so much, Colm McCann, for joining us here today.
Thank you so much.